Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the podcast. I'm Chad Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team.
I am Tor Norby from the Android Tools team. And today we have an exciting guest.
Ooh, drum roll, please.
You guys, I can't make it today.
Yeah, we did have another guest bail on us. Was it for the first time? No, it was the second. No, actually, it was the fourth. It was the fourth time we've had a guest bail on us. Same guest.
It was not so, Chris this time, so he's off the hook. Another guest.
Yeah.
So if in a future podcast we sound a bit strained talking to one of the guests, then you'll know who that guest was.
In the meantime, we thought we would instead today have as a guest, want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, me, Tor.
All right.
We could talk about tools.
Pretty much. That's kind of what I expect when you come in here. Even if we're talking about something that has nothing to do with tools, I still expect you to talk about tools.
Yeah, I want to make it interesting.
So we had major tools release, right before the holiday, around Android Dev Summit time, which was conveniently during the week of Thanksgiving, which meant that all developers in the U.S. were really excited about that timing. So we had the release. Was it beta release or full release?
It still has not reached beta. We are getting close.
Okay.
So that was basically a preview release.
Okay.
And since then, we've had four previews. We are putting together preview 5 today, but by the time that listeners hear this, it's probably out.
So we thought the timing was pretty good, especially since we had a guest bail on us. Timing was pretty good to actually talk a little bit more in depth and around the edges of some of the stuff that we saw at the Dev Summit, or which has come into the release since then, or just the stuff that you're working on for this big release that is, you know, doing sort of a slow burn rollout over time.
Yeah, that's the way we like to do it. We use the Canary channel. A lot of users are opted into it. They have opted into the Canary channel. When you download Studio, you get the stable channel by default, but you can switch to Canary, and that's what you do if you want the latest and greatest.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Canary does imply that a living being will die, right? That is the purpose of Canaries.
I think the purpose is for the coal miners to find out that they are about to die because the canary already died from the poisonous gases
right,
in the mine.
Right. So we're not talking about, so the miners won't because the canary did.
That's right.
Right. Okay.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice name for the release. Great.
We actually switched IntelliDesk terminology for this. They have the EA and some other, they have various names for their channels, and I can't remember what they are, except that EA is their main name. And we switched all the channel names to follow the Chrome terminology. So we go with canary, dev, beta and stable. But we don't actually use it in the way Chrome does, in that our canary is not really a nightly build that we haven't touched at all. It really is something that we've given a little bit of attention to. And we roll them out about once a week if things go well. They haven't for about a month. That's not actually true. Things have been fairly good, except, you know, with the holidays and everything. And we've done some big changes that I'll talk about shortly. So it's usually weekly. We do some testing and then we send it out there. And then we get a lot of help, basically, with bug reports on platforms that we can't run, or, you know, advanced features that we don't have unit tests for, that kind of thing.
So it's like a canary with a gas mask.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Basically.
All right. So onto the features. I see you have a laptop in front of you because apparently there are so many features that you can't keep them all in your mind. So let's talk about some of the big ones. So the big theme for the release was...
kitchen sink. How's that? No, we had sort of three large themes on the Android Studio or on the Android Tools team last year. And they were stability, they were performance, and they were emulator, right? So performance primarily concerns itself with build performance, right? So a big complaint from our users forever has been that builds are slow. And, you know, back in the Eclipse days, builds were slow. With Studio and Gradle, they got even slower. Of course, Gradle does a lot more, but again, it didn't help that we didn't have background compilation, right? So with Gradle, you can have all these plugins that plug into the build system, but that makes it really hard for the IDE to go and guess and incrementally, you know, compile a file after you save, because it could be doing a lot of other stuff in the pipeline. And in fact, the data binding plugin does just such a thing, right? So we don't have incremental compilation anymore in the sense that Eclipse did in terms of compile on save. So builds got even slower. So a big theme this year was to make builds much faster. The internal project name was 10x, right? We wanted builds to be 10x faster. I think what we delivered is actually more than 10x, but there's a bunch of different scenarios for that, right? So the first thing we did was to look at the cold build pipeline, meaning that when you're not running anything, you're just building clean, make that faster, right? So one of the things we're doing is we're running Dex in process, which helps a lot. Another thing we're doing is we discovered that the Dex merging algorithm was really, really bad, as in, you know, I think quadratic or something like that. So when you have a large number of files, it gets very, very slow. And so there's hacks that people do where they sort the files in a certain order to make it slightly better, but still didn't help. And so we had an algorithmic improvement to Dex that made it faster. So there were several things that just made builds quite a bit faster in the new build system, the command line tools that we ship. But the biggest thing, of course, is this thing called Instant Run, so which is what we called 10x before internally. And Instant Run is a number of different tricks where we can build less, right? So in the best case, you're just changing certain things inside a method body, for example, right? You're stepping through your code or you're running it and you see, oh no, I need to trim that string. You can just make that code change, hit run, and within 500 milliseconds, your app continues to run, but with that fix applied on the fly. And the way that works is when you build your code with our plugin, with our Gradle plugin, we are actually instrumenting your code. What happens technically is that every single method in your code, so not in libraries, but in your code, we insert a small check at the beginning of the method to see, have I been updated yet? And if not, it just does what it normally does. So we're basically solving this like every other computer science problem with one level of indirection, right? So when you hit that instant run button, we recompile your class, the new modified class, and we send that to the device. And then we update the pointers in the old class to the new class. So suddenly, you know, this method that you had before will now point to the new class instead and execute there. That's how it works. That's basically the hot swap.
So this is you're instrumenting the code, so it's all debug builds are automatically instrumented? Like or dev builds? I don't know how you just
exactly.
The IDE.
Yeah. We don't do this in release builds at all. This is a development feature only. Right. So in developer builds, we do that to your code. So when you pull in app compatter or whatever, we don't instrument app compat. We don't prepare that for hot swap, right? But all your own code, we do this too. And so when it's running on your real device or on your emulator, it's going to have this done to it. And that's how we can support hot swap, not with like some sort of modified framework or modified emulator. It works on real devices. And that's because it's some pretty simple code manipulation we're doing to do this, right? The other half is how do we actually send the code to the device? Well, we also modify your app to have a server in it that we can talk to via a socket, right? So we set up a tunnel with ADB and then we send patches to your running app and then we apply it there. So that's hot swap. And we also let you change resources. Or in some cases, you're changing code, for example, code in onCreate, right? So you've changed your onCreate handler. And we push that code change, but nothing happens in your app, right? Because you're not going to be running onCreate again unless you trigger an activity restart. And that's what we call the warm start. So hot swap is kind of, you know, you can kind of think of what that means, right? Hot swap is a pretty well-known term in computer science. I remember Sun Microsystems, they even supported hot swapping motherboards, as I recall, on some of those expensive computers. So
they were really hot swap.
Yes. The boards were hot. So warm swap is when we are doing changes to your running app, but we need to also restart your activities. So we do that for resource changes, and you can even optionally do it if you've changed something. For example, your onCreate handler. You can either press a key binding and have it restart the activity, or you can opt into the automatic restart of activities when we send a hot swap patch across the wire.
Okay, so Android Studio by default does not know whether you need a warm or a hot swap. But you can tell.
Well, we know if it's a resource change.
Resources.
Yeah. If it's hot, we don't know. We have talked about doing certain heuristics, right? If we see that the code changes are all in onCreate, you probably want it. But if it's in some random class and the call graph to get there is, you know, seven levels deep and maybe does some conditional checking, we don't know, right? And so we debated back and forth on the team. Should we make this by default true or false, right? Because by some argument, if you don't really know what's happening, you probably want an activity restart. After all, Android does it all the time, right? Anytime you change your screen orientation, there is an activity restart happening. So your app should arguably be behaving well with activity restarts. On the other hand, if you look at, for example, Romain Guy's demo that we did at the Dev Summit, you know, the chessboard thingy, there, an activity restart is pretty expensive. It's an OpenGL thing with texture loading and everything. And so we thought, let's compromise. So what happens now is when you do this, we give you a little pop-up inside, like a dismissible or ignorable tool window pop-up in the IDE that says, hey, we've applied some patches, but your app did not restart. So, press Command-Shift-R or whatever the key binding is on that platform. We look it up dynamically to restart the activity.
Every time you do this?
Every time you do it.
Okay.
Until you say, don't show me this message again, or until you actually opt into that.
Or you could potentially just when they compile, every time they do a save, you could pop up a dialogue and says, we noticed that you saved some code, and then just take them through probably a 25-step control flow decision tree to determine how to swap on the end.
Yeah, so that's one that might be something to, since you're an Eclipse user, I should explain that. Actions on save is not really an IntelliJ thing. That is an Eclipse thing. So in Eclipse, that basically they didn't run inspections until you saved. And on save is when they would update their markers. That's not how IntelliJ or Android Studio works. It basically happens on the fly. If you just pause, it'll rerun these things. And in fact, saving is a no-op now, mostly in IntelliJ. They do save immediately, but it'll also auto-save if you tab out of the window, if you switch files. They've taken saving out. It's always saving for you because they have, perfect undo, basically, across multi-file changes as well. So we've had some people file bugs saying, hey, why don't you show the asterisk in the title bar when the file is modified? They used to do that in the past to show you which files are saved and which ones aren't. But when they went to this model where everything is saved automatically, they just got rid of it because, you shouldn't really think about it. You're just making edits and undo if you have to. But this concept of having seven unsaved buffers, like in Emacs, it's gone. They don't do that.
All right. So that was cold, warm, and hot. And
I haven't talked about cold yet. So, well, I did talk about it. Well, that's true. I did talk about starting from clean, but that actually isn't what we called cold swap.
Wait, so what's clean then?
Okay.
We need another temperature.
Right. You start out with brand new project, right? You haven't built it all. That's clean, right? Okay. And hitting run then will do basically what it always has, is it'll build everything from scratch. It'll compile all the Java, it'll convert to DEX, it'll build the APK, it'll package the resources, and then it'll do an ADB to push it to the device, and then it'll do an activity manager start. So those are all the steps it has to do.
And some of that stuff has gotten faster just through, clever ways.
That's right. And I also forgot to say that we made the ADB push much faster with the new emulator.
Okay.
Much, much faster than real devices too, and it used to be slower. So that's the clean build. And then we jumped to the opposite end of the scale, which was hot swap. You make a code change. It's a compatible code change, something simple like changing the implementation of a method. Those we can immediately apply. Warm swap is when we restart activities, and usually we do this for resource changes where we also have to do a crazy set of reflection stuff in the toolkit to make, for example, your activity use the new, pick up a new version of the theme, which picks up your new changes to colors and styles and things like that. And then there's code swap. And code swap typically happens when you're making a change to your code and you decide to, for example, add a new field or rename a method. Those are things we can't currently hot swap. Now, we have some plans for being able to do a larger set of these changes, even in a hot swap scenario. For example, you can imagine that deleting a method is pretty compatible, right? We're just going to ignore that. That's the simplest case I can imagine, right? Deleting a method, we can compatibly do it. But right now, basically anything that changes the structure of a class, we treat as incompatible with a hot or warm swap. We force a cold swap. So what happens there is we send the patch across and then we restart the app, basically, from scratch. And so what we're about to ship, so we didn't actually support cold swap in the previews that had been public until this point, right? So we demoed it on stage at the Dev Summit, but it was really, really, risky. If you went too far from the demo scenario. Whereas now we think it's working pretty well, so we're about to ship that. And there are a bunch of different scenarios for this. So what we demoed was the behavior we have on older platforms up to prior to Lollipop. So that would be what, KitKat? That's using Dalvik, basically, where we create a single reload class that we put into the class path. We modify your app to put this in its class loader at startup. Then that's basically how it works. On 21 to 22, we basically can't do that because Art is really smart about optimizing stuff, but some of those optimizations makes it very tricky to replace some classes later. So we have to basically shard all the classes into the same sets of class files every time. So when you make a change, and let's say we've taken your application, we split it into 15 fragments or shards, right? If you change one class, we will recompile all the classes in that shard and re-dex all those and send those as a unit. So we're still dividing the size, the amount of dexing that we have to do into 10. And we're still not doing a full ADB push or an ADB reinstall. So it still is a massive speed gain, right? To only recompile some stuff and push that across and restart. And so that's what happens on Lollipop. And then finally on M, we are using APK splits, which is a new feature the platform has where you can take your app and you can package it into separate APK files. So for example, you can deliver your resources, your icons, for example, in different densities with different APKs. So a user doesn't have to download all of them. They can download the base app plus the language and the assets for their density, for example. So we're using that facility for CodeSwap, where we basically shard your app again, but instead of doing what we do on Lollipop, we're using APK splits for each one of those fragments of the app and using ADB to push those across. So there's fewer hacks basically with class loaders on M and Up. So this is, there's a lot of complex code to do this, but that's the three different cases we have for CodeSwap. And that's not all. We also have something called FreeSwap, which we haven't talked about before, right? And the difference between CodeSwap and FreeSwap is that FreeSwap is really where it's even colder than cold, right? And that means that not only are we having to restart the app, but the app isn't even running when we do this. So basically with a CodeSwap, we're still talking to the server and we got a code change, we're sending the patch across to that app, and then it restarts itself. With FreeSwap, we have to not talk to the app, figure out with ADB what's running on the device, what could be running on the device but isn't, build it, then push those things over to the app, putting it in like an inbox effectively with ADB, and then using Activity Manager to start it, and then it on the fly will go and fetch what it needs to run. So that's if you then add clean, we have 5 levels. So this is probably more than you ever want to know about instant run. The net result should be that you as a user will basically just hit run. That is the UI we wanted with this. That you shouldn't have to think of, well, do I want to run or do I want to push changes? No, you basically just run. And generally, we do the least amount of work necessary to make your app update to reflect whatever changes you've done. So, we also put a little pop-up again in the run window that tells you why it wasn't eligible for hot swap. So it'll say, hey, you added a field or you changed a method. So you sometimes you'll learn, hey, maybe, I just want to test this, but I won't rename this yet because I want to continue with this run right now.
Okay. Yeah, there's like a lot of, my decision tree actually just expanded. I think it's about 72 nodes now.
Yeah.
Many dialogues. So in the Goldilocks story, there's only 3 choices, right? There's hot and there's cold, and then obviously she chooses warm. If she had this many options, then she'd probably just give up. She would go hungry. She'd probably go find a bed, but there's too many beds to choose from. It just gets very complicated. So,
well, I think that you could call the instant run button the Goldilocks button because it is the just right button. It'll do whatever is right. Right? She doesn't have to choose between, the large bowl of porridge or the small bowl. She'll just press, porridge, and it'll do the right thing.
Okay. Is that the one that automatically warms, that relaunches the activity?
Well, so again, we had a trade-off on that one where we basically don't restart the activity,
right,
if you've only changed code.
But then you pop up the little toast that
says. I think I'm afraid to use the term pop-up because it's not really a pop-up. It is a balloon. And, so I don't know if you've seen this in studio. We have all kinds of different UI feedback, too much, in fact. So we've tweaked the UI since the previews where they were using some top right balloons and some bottom level, balloons.
And they're all different colors too. Sometimes I get green rectangles and pink rectangles and gray rectangles with red lettering inside of it. It all looks very, very terrifying. Obviously, I've done something wrong and I never understand the language that they're using to tell me what I've done.
Yeah. So when we post the balloon, we can choose the severity and it can be informational, warning, or error. And it turns out those map to different colors. So green means that we use the severity information. Right? And yellow is warning and red is error. And so one of the things we've done now is we, for example, changed the verifier failure, the one that says, hey, you couldn't actually hot swap. We switched from warning to informational because really we just want everything to be green unless it's really a problem.
Right.
We are telling you that you can't use older versions of the Gradle plugin, like alpha 1, 2, or 3 for this, in this new version to work with hot swap. That we made yellow because you need to understand that, hey, click here to upgrade your project. That's generally it. So we're trying to unify a bit what the color, which severities we pick for these things to make sure that there's less variation.
It might also make it friendlier to the users if you use like an icon, some sort of character, like, I don't know, a friendly looking paperclip next to these warnings as well.
Nicely done. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe by the full release, you'll have something like that. Just take that down as a feature, would you? All right. So performance. That was that the extent of performance? The, you know, internal 10x thing?
Well, or, you know, we
were there other performance
things? We're always looking at performance, but that was by far the biggest things. Make builds faster. Make cold builds faster. Make, you know, incremental builds possible. You know, we're always tweaking the IDE and things like that. But I don't think there's anything else I can think of. Unless we start talking about the emulator, which I have much less to say about. It's a massive amount of work, and, you know, lots of people working on it, and performance of the emulator was a critical thing. So clearly performance is there as one of the main things they worked on, right? Not just the A to B push performance, but like the whole thing, plus a brand new UI, plus brand new lots of new features, right? So it's very easy to, for example, mock a map's location. In fact, you just say, hey, I want you to pretend that the GPS returns this, and you get like a maps view that you can like just click and say here. Or you can even say, hey, I want to pretend that I'm moving. So you can draw a path and then it'll simulate the GPS moving. And that's just one of the examples. There's, I think basically all the sensors can be configured through nice UI options now. So yeah, that's the brand new emulator, and they're still working on it. And I assume they'll do a beta near our beta.
Okay, so was the emulator... was that out with the previews, or was that a separate thing?
It was announced with the at the Dev Summit. Yeah. But at the Dev Summit, we released a preview of Studio. We did not release a preview of the emulator, but we have since. So you can get the emulator 2.0 preview now. Okay. It's available, and I think they're shipping regular updates as well. Yeah. The emulator is actually distributed through the SDK tools, not through the IDE. It's not bundled inside, you know, Anusudu.app on Mac, for example, right? So it's a slightly different mechanism. But we have this facility in the IDE to alert you. It's one of those many pop-ups that you ignore, right? That says, hey, I have a new version of the support library. You can install. Click here. So we also pushed emulator that way. Though the emulator is part of the SDK tools, which is a very generic sounding name.
Kind of.
But it turns out SDK tools at this point is basically just emulator. We used to have more stuff in there. But, you know, as we've migrated the SDK manager into the IDE and more and more things, there's really not much left in the SDK tools package to the point that we should probably just rename it the emulator. Now, I see you looking...
Well, so yeah, looking askance or at least puzzled. So why is it separate? So is there a need for the emulator to run separately from the IDE? Is there a reason to bundle it differently?
Well, so there's a bunch of stuff that ships in SDK, right? So the SDK tools is one. There's also platform tools, yeah, which is where ADB lives. There's build tools, which is where AAPT lives. There's the platforms where the SDK lives. The emulator arguably could be used, for example, from Gradle connected tests, right? So you run Gradle and you run your build tests, and they actually start an emulator and they're deploying to it, for example.
I mean, outside now, like command line tools?
Yeah, on the build server, right, for example, right? Okay. Now, you know, could run Anusudu on the build server if you want to. You know, you should run Studio whenever you want, but it's probably not so common.
All the time.
Yeah. So we absolutely could bundle emulator with Studio, but they are slightly different, right? There's a lot of things that Studio depends on that isn't bundled with Studio. It depends on, you know, well, the build system, for example, which isn't inside Studio. It's separate. Okay.
All right, so there are reasons.
Yeah.
We'll put quotes around reasons.
Reasons.
I'm going to put two quotes around them. Okay. All right. So that's all the information that anybody ever wanted to know about the emulator. How about moving on to a different area then? The third one was stability. Was there anything there? Or it was just like, well, we fixed a lot of bugs.
We did fix a lot of bugs. Like, we had fix-its where we basically did nothing but have everyone get together and fix bugs and have daily status meetings. And so the nice thing about that was it sort of put everyone in the same boat. You know, like, no one's working on fun features. We are going to go back and we're going to dig through bugs that have been in the issue tracker forever. And believe me, we're nowhere near done, right? I mean, we still have lots and lots of bugs filed against us. It's a very, very large product, right? You can file any request you want on anything in the IDE. Hey, you know, the Mercurial support doesn't do blah, 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 right? But we went back and looked at some of the most highly starred bugs or clusters of issues and sort of spent some time digging into it and fixed a lot of things that were longstanding problems. So, you know, those actually, a lot of them shipped in 1.5 actually, but that was sort of a 6-month effort of just really kind of focusing on stability, really, to try to make sure that we don't only add new stuff, arguably new stuff like Instant Run that people want, but also make sure that we don't just forget about some of these longer standing problems.
So Fix It Week, that seems to have worked out a lot better than the previous Break It Weeks that you held for years and years. I never quite understood the purpose of those, but I mean, it seemed fun.
Well, it was a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
So actually, this is sort of an interesting dynamic in software engineering in general, especially with large and growing projects. Like, you know, you do something at the start, let's say Android at the start, you basically jam on features and functionality. You get to the thing to the point where it's useful for someone outside the engineer working on it. And then more people join the team, and then you have to have, you know, backward compatible support for APIs and functionality and more code than more engineers, and some engineers, you know, there's turnover or whatever. And then eventually you reach a state where it's like, yeah, we want to keep adding functionality, but just maintaining the robustness of the platform becomes a more and more serious trade-off that you have to think about. And then there's also, like, you know, these nuances like team morale, where you can't just, you know, stick the new people with the bug fixes, A, because they may not even know the code, and B, because, well, you know, why does that person get to work on the fun features and I'm over here doing maintenance stuff? So it's
well, and it's particularly hard to go and fix bugs that no one really owns, right? It's one thing to go and fix a bug in your code. Like, yeah, clearly you're responsible. You broke it, you fix it. But when you get this bug that, hey, you know, something weird happens with, like, Hungarian keyboards, the Alt-Gur key doesn't work in the output window. Who's going to go fix that, right? Well, someone needs to. And that's kind of what some of the this was aimed at.
All right, and so that worked, and all the bugs got fixed, so that's great.
Yeah, we still have a few. Okay. And so I got to say, I'm really thankful for that, right, that we have users who are willing to go into and log, you know, have an account and go in and log in and give us details, and when we ask for more, they follow up, and that's fabulous. So I'm really happy about that.
So what's your bug run rate like? Do you know? I would be curious how many sort of come in. I mean, I'm sure it comes in waves, right? But certainly the flow, the inflow has to be somewhat constant. The rate at which you can fix those probably depends on, you know, fix it weeks or whether you're trying to get a release ready or whatever. I don't know. Maybe that's one of those questions I shouldn't ask or nobody really knows the answer to.
I don't have really good answers. I do know that we, in the past, have been unable to keep up. You know, it's almost like a support channel, right? That it's a, you know, I think the internal bug tracker at Google is kind of nice because everyone who files bugs, you know, it's your coworkers, so they don't want to be embarrassed when you go back and saying, hey, you know, you didn't give me, this was a useless bug report, right? With a public one, you get everything from really amazing bug reports, right? From people who clearly are software engineers and who have had bug reports filed against themselves, and they know what you'll need. And they've actually followed the instructions that we put into every bug report saying, please follow these detailed instructions for what we need.
Sometimes even with fixes. Right. I've had bugs filed with, oh, and by the way, here's the lines of code to fix it.
Yeah, that's amazing. We don't get a whole lot of those. Those tend to come in terms of a Garrett code review instead, but we do occasionally get it. We get some good reports, but we get a lot of half-specified bug reports and a pretty large number of really useless bug reports too, where, like, hey, you know, here's my homework assignment. Why doesn't it work? We get some of those.
Right. And a lot of duplicates as well, because I have filed many duplicates over my lifetime because it's really hard to search for a bug, you know, to know exactly what you're looking for a particular bug.
Yeah, and I think it's unrealistic to expect that the person submitting the bug is going to be doing a deep search of a bug database. Yeah. And really, if you are the person who's doing the triaging of bugs, you probably know. If there was a recent big breakage, there's going to be 50 duplicates of this. And so you kind of have, I had a document, right, where I kept track of the most common IDs. I didn't have to go like, oh, look, it's the bug about, you know, some missing crypto library in the JRE again here. Okay, that's the bug report. Boom.
Yeah.
So we have that as well. So the I think our rate is really good for, like, the most critical bugs. But when it comes to, like, enhancement requests, that's an ever-growing graph of bugs, right, or requests. There's so many things you could do. We don't have time for everything. But it's useful.
Yeah. Maybe you could hold an enhancement it week just to implement.
Well, we're always doing that, right? So we are talking to our users about what are some things they need, and we're trying to address that with the features we're targeting for each release. So these tend to be sort of more, I don't want to say low-hanging fruit because some of it is not easy. But, you know, they tend not to be large themes of things. They tend to be like, hey, I would like this little feature.
Right.
In fact, you know, if I look at sort of the next set of things I want to talk about, they're very, very near and dear to my heart. They're like in the static analysis and lint area. And so one thing we recently added was something that had been requested a number of times, which was to have automated unused resource removal. So we've had this for a while at the Gradle level, right? Which which is better in many ways. And what that means is that you can opt into resource shrinking with Gradle. And then we look at, and this only applies to release builds where you're using ProGuard, right? So you're actually already shrinking your code. And when you do that, after shrinking your code to like strip out any code you're not using, we then look to see, well, what resources are now referenced from the only code you are using? And then anything that isn't used, we delete. There are some limitations to this. For one thing, we can't release not value resources. We need some support in APD for that. But it turns out we can strip out things like images, which is where the largest assets tend to be anyway. And the advantage of this is we can strip out resources from libraries, which aren't your code, but clearly we could do it at linktime. Nice. And that's the big win, right? So you may depend on Play Services, and you're pulling in all of Play Services, and you're getting all the assets from Play Services, right? But if you are only making one method call and that one doesn't use a resource, you're still getting the like the Google Plus sign-in button logos, right? Whereas this basically would strip it out because you don't call the method which is referencing that. But that's the big win with resource shrinking. And in fact, in the new Gradle plugin, we just fixed a bunch of bugs around the resource shrinker. So it should work better for a lot of people now.
So ProGuard, obviously it does code removal. It does not or cannot do resource removal?
That's correct.
Okay. Was that on the list, or it's just too generic a tool? It just can't do that static analysis?
ProGuard is very old. I want to say it's like 20 years old, and it's not Android-specific at all. You know, I think the author of it has written a new, brand-new tool. I can't remember what it's called. I want to say it's something like DexGuard, but I could be wrong about that. Eric LaFortune, anyway. And so I think that tool might be doing a lot more of this. In fact, when I announced that I worked on the resource shrinker, he came up to me at Google I/O one year and said, oh, actually, I just was working on that for Dex, his tool too. So I think that might be doing it, but ProGuard itself does not do it. Okay. And speaking of that, actually, we have a new shrinker that we are adding to the Gradle plugin, and I think that is also going out in this release. This release I keep referring to now is Alpha 5 of the Gradle 2.0 plugin, which by the time listeners hear this, it should be available. And what the new shrinker does is, unlike ProGuard, it works. It should be very fast, and it's not meant for release stripping. It's really meant for, you know, in a debug build, working incrementally and letting you deal with the 64K method limit, right? So it can very quickly prune down what your dependencies are, and that's its purpose. So yeah, we have a new code shrinker and a new resource shrinker. There's more stuff on Lit. So I mentioned the unused resource detector. We actually made there's now a quick fix for that and a full refactoring. So you go to refactoring menu in Studio and say remove unused resources. That cannot go and remove resources from library. So it can't go into app compat again, right? Because like you can't edit it, but B, so this is really more for removing things in your project that you're not using. We also made it much smarter now. So it actually looks at sort of the transitive usages, right? So until now, if any code or if any resource referenced your resource, so if you have a layout that's being included by another layout, we would never let you delete that as unused because there's a reference to it. But now we look transitively. So if a resource is only referenced by other resources that are also recursively unused, they can all be deleted. So it's better in that regard. The other, I think, big change is API check, right? So do you know what API check is, the API lint check?
Let's pretend I do.
Okay. So in the past, what developers used to do was if you had a min SDK of, let's say, Gingerbread, you would compile with a Gingerbread SDK to make sure you didn't accidentally call, let's say, a ice cream sandwich API, because then it would crash at runtime if running on a Gingerbread device or Honeycomb. So that was the practice in the past, was like just compile with the latest. But it made it very difficult if you, let's say you wanted to support all the features up through Jelly Bean, but you also wanted to run on Gingerbread, you had to use Reflection to access anything not in Gingerbread, which is very, very inconvenient. So the new recommendation we have is to compile with the latest and greatest. So today, you should compile with 23. You can still have a min SDK of 10. And the reason it's safe to do that is that Lint is looking at every single field reference and class reference and method reference in your code. And if they're higher than the min SDK, it'll flag them. Unless, you know, that call is surrounded by an actual explicit version check, like if SDK, you know, is greater than whatever. So it turns out that there was one other way that things could crash. And that is because sometimes the Android APIs will change superclasses or add interfaces later, right? So for example, I think key event it started extending input event only in API 9, right? So if you have code, so if you're compiling with a new API, the compiler will very happily, whenever it sees an input event, it'll gladly cast the key event to that. But it turns out that prior to 9, that wouldn't work. It would crash. And this can happen anywhere in your code. This isn't anywhere there's like an explicit call. This can happen on an assignment. You can say, you know, key event X equals something. Actually, I got it backwards, like input event X equals, and then something that is a key event. That's just an assignment. And this can happen when you know, in a parameter. It can happen anywhere with a cast. And this was something we actually were missing in Lint, and that's just been added in this new version. So, you know, I think you definitely want to run Studio on your code and just make sure you don't have one of these things lurking. So now we're tracking basically all the changes in interfaces and superclass hierarchies across all the API levels. So
okay. So and the your MinSDK reference made me realize, like, it's easy to get confused between there's MinSDK, there's Target SDK version, there's Compile SDK version.
Mm-hmm.
There's also Max SDK version, which I think is not terribly used.
Well, it's not only not used, you should not use it.
Yeah.
I think that it's actually ignored. It was not ignored in the very oldest versions of Android. So like back in like the pre-Froyo days, I think it might have had a meaning.
Okay.
Now you just don't use it.
Maybe we should just rename it to be Emacs SDK for the people that want to use, you know, command line tools instead of...
That's right. IDs. Yeah.
Okay. So then the compile SDK means basically crash if I'm actually referencing something that is beyond that, right? Not a crash. I mean, break the build.
Yeah, exactly. Because compile SDK version, unlike MinSDK version, Target SDK version, and Max SDK version, those last three, and let's just pretend there's two of them, Min and Target, those are actually in your manifest, and they're passed to your running app, right? So the platform can decide, and it does decide. Target SDK is used at runtime to decide whether or not to opt you into certain features, right?
Yep.
Compile SDK version is not an Android runtime concept. That is a concept we have at build time. It basically says, which Android.jar are we compiling you with? That's really all it means.
Okay. Does that actually choose between, as you were saying before, the Gingerbread platform versus, you know, API 23 platform?
Yes. If you have a Compile SDK version set to, let's say, 15, you have to have a Gingerbread SDK installed or it won't compile. So this is really just pointing to the right directory in the platforms directory for us to compile with. This isn't a number that goes into your app in some way and is interpreted.
Yep.
But they really are very related. In fact, in the older versions of the new project dialogue, we used to ask you for all three, and we had a long explanation of each. As part of our UI cleanup at some point, we decided this was too much for new developers to have to face. But it is a bit unfortunate because, you know, users don't always get this. And that was the rationale for why in earlier builds we actually had three separate toggles. When you make a new project, you had to choose all three. And we had like a long explanation text to try to make it clear.
It was now a beautiful dialogue too in previous IDEs.
I love this. So ugly. Yeah. So now what we do, we only ask you for the MinSDK version. And we automatically set Compile SDK version to the latest because that is the recommended practice.
Okay.
Target, we're also setting to the highest known at the time of when you're making the project, we pick the highest that's known at that point. Developers may want to go and tweak that, right? The hardest thing about changing your Target SDK version is that there's some changes in runtime behavior based on what you want. And so I think the most famous case of that is probably now in M, right, where it opts you into a new permission model.
That's probably the widest reaching version of that. We do use this in very targeted cases internally, at least in the framework code, where we will sometimes encounter a bug and we say, well, the right behavior is for it to do this, right? So we should fix this bug because it should never have behaved this other way. However, now that people have been writing code to that behavior for years, it's a little bit dangerous to flip that switch now and apps that were simply, you know, put on Play Store, you know, a couple of years ago and downloaded onto this new version of the SDK will now like inherit this new behavior, potentially, you know, having undefined behavior because the app developer didn't expect it. So at that point, we may decide, okay, this is the correct behavior for it to have. However, in order to guard against, you know, weird artifacts that are unexpected, we will put it inside a Target SDK switch.
Yeah, so I think a good way to think of it is MinSDK version is the oldest kind of phone you want to support, a phone or tablet or whatever. And the lower number you pick, the larger, you know, segment of the users out there you will be able to target.
And Play Store will not allow it to go onto phones older or older than the min that you pick.
Yeah, and I think right now in studio, we basically pick 15 for you because that gives you 90-some percent. And arguably, you could probably go to 17 at this point. I think it's still 90-something. Target is the one to think of, like, this is the highest version I've tested with, right? So you should always just pick the highest you can. And if you had a lower number and you changed it, because Lint will tell you, hey, you're not using the latest here, you should just switch it and try and test your app. If it's broken, that's when you go and consult the documentation. And I think the version codes, Javadoc is, so android.os.build, is that it? And there's like a version codes field. That's where we document for each level the changes in compat behavior. Right. So you can, so like if your target used to be 16, you're switching 23, you could sort of cumulatively work your way through each level to see what is it you ha- what is it that we've changed for the runtime behavior.
All right. Cool. So I wanted to mention, I don't know if you were going to get there, but the other thing I thought was cool in the new Android Studio stuff that we saw at the preview were some of the new tools or changes to the existing tools inside of Android Studio, the plugins. So there was Memory Monitor was already out there. I think that came out at like I/O last year. But there's also the GPU performance monitor. So this is something that used to purely be on device, and now you can actually see that monitor. You can see the same information inside the IDE.
Yeah, with a sort of a sliding timeline.
Yep.
And you can also, for, I know for the, at least for the heap viewer, there's some new features there, right? So one of the things it does is it will automatically analyze the heap and look for known problems. So one of the things that, I think we have two checks right now, but the plan is to have more. And the first one of those is the most interesting, which it looks for leaked activities. So in an earlier episode of this podcast, we had
PY,
you know, from Square talk about leak canary.
Canary again. Yep.
Yes.
Yep. Dead leaks. Dead from leaks. It makes sense.
That's right. So this is doing the same thing, but sort of statically. So you don't have to put it in your code. You can just grab a heap dump from your app, which you can do anytime, right? From the monitor again. Your app is running. The monitor is sort of showing its memory profile, you know, as a graph. And you just click a button and it grabs a heap dump, opens it up, and then you just like, look for leaked activities, and it'll tell you. It'll also find duplicated strings, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Leaked activities and duplicated strings. I can't think of sort of two more extreme cases of artifacts you may have in Android. But does it still have a really attractive, like, was that a cylinder icon for take the heap dump?
Yeah, I don't.
In the original the ADT plugin, the, you know, or the
well,
monitor.
I do know we redid all the icons as part of the, you know, when we re-implemented a bunch of functionality.
Yeah. DDMS, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah. DDMS tool, it was like the cylinder icon with a red arrow on it or something.
Yeah, some of those icons were mysterious. And I think I've told you the story before about the DDMS icon itself. Did I tell you the story? So forgive me, you or listeners, if I'm repeating myself. I can't remember because I this is one of my favorite stories. But we had this really odd icon for the DDMS tool, which was sort of the, you know, the Dalvik instrumentation window, and it was like some blue and some orange stuff, and I could not figure it out. And so I asked Zav, my you know coworker who'd worked on it before, and he said, actually, yeah, that's basically Dalvik. That is a screen. Someone went to Google Maps, found Dalvik, which is a place in Iceland that Dalvik is named for, and sort of grabbed that fjord and made a screenshot out of it. So that's the blue and orange. It's basically the topography of Dalvik, which I thought was fun. So we didn't exactly keep that icon.
No. Fun. Not comprehensible.
Yeah.
But, yeah, fun. All right. What else we got?
We'll see. Well, that's it, really. Okay. No, there's a bunch of more stuff in Lint, which I track, obviously, a bit more closely than everything else, right? So there we have a bunch of new checks. We had, like, a number. Actually, we had several external submissions as well, security checks that do some really great stuff looking for SSL vulnerabilities and things like that. And we've ported them all to not be bytecode-based, but to be basically using the AST, because that means they can run on the fly in the IDE. So, you know, an even larger number of them now are running in the background in the IDE, as opposed to sort of only from the command line with Gradle, where it does classified analysis. And that goes back to the thing we talked about earlier, where when Lint was first written, it was running inside of Eclipse as well as on the command line. And in Eclipse and on the command line, there was always class files, right? So you hit Control-S, and to save your file, you know, we would compile it, and then we'd run Lint on that one class file. That doesn't work in IntelliJ Studio, where there is no background compilation. So that's why it's more important to do it sort of on the live editor contents, not on future bytecode. So that's why almost all the Lints have now been rewritten to be non-bytecode based. Yeah, and there's several new Lint checks as well. So I think I said I'm sure I'm going to really offend some coworkers now that I probably forgot their favorite features that they worked on. There's actually, I should say, a bunch of people doing really, really great work on technical debt, right? So the SDK manager is being completely rewritten. It's going to have many new features too, but it's just a much better foundation for a lot of things we're doing. And like the wizards are all been rewritten, the infrastructure for how that works. Because we used to have a lot of bugs in this area where like go back and forth a few times and then data's not up to date and whatever. Now we have a new infrastructure and it's all much better. So there's several people just kind of working on making the code base just, you know, infinitely better.
There's new app templates as well that have been coming online. I don't think that's specific to this release, but certainly over time.
We keep tweaking those. And in fact, that's true. We did a bunch of work on that in the 1.5.2.0 timeframe as well to bring them all up to material design, yep. Right? So there's a new design library and all of our templates used to not use them. So you would get really dated looking activities out of Android Studio. And now it's used in the design library instead. So it should all be, you know, much closer to what you recommended. So you have a little fab floating action button in the bottom right, for example.
Yep. Let's see. I'm trying to remember some of the other tools. I will put a link to the Android Dev Summit videos that came out immediately after the summit. There was a super long session with a bunch of the developers on the team talking about the tools that they were working on, some of the plugins.
That's true. And I think that there are many, many talks from the summit. I think all of them are good. But there was one talk that I saw a lot of people were really excited about, and that was the tips and tricks session, sort of advanced usage of Android Studio. And the whole point of that session was not to cover what we've implemented recently. It was to go through things we thought that daily usage of Studio might not know and would find productive. So you had six people who all went through and sort of picked, you know, not just their favorite features, because everyone would say things like code completion, right? Which everyone knows already. So we found things that we thought people will probably be impressed or excited or find some use out of this feature. And the feedback I saw on social media was really, really good. People, even long-term users.
Just your mom tweeting?
No. Okay. So I think that's a session we definitely should put in the show notes if people didn't see it. Because I think that, you know, even fairly expert Android users, I mean, you know, when we had a rehearsal of the talk, you know, we all learned things from each other too. I think my favorite feature that I didn't know, sadly, didn't actually work in the live demo, which we were bummed about, because like that was the coolest thing. That was Shiva showing the debugger. And I didn't know that you could very easily, for a data structure, go and add a quick little visualizer. You could sort of say, here, I want you to print this when you see this. And when he did this in a rehearsal, everyone was like, wow, that's amazing. But then sadly, during the actual summit demo, it didn't work. So I think people in the audience might have gone, that probably wasn't anything big, but that was like my favorite thing.
So, all right. Yeah, we can put that in the show notes, except we can't link to Shiva's demo because it didn't work.
Well, there were many other things he did show. So each one of these demos were between 5 and 15 minutes long. Yep. So they're, you know, even if you open this YouTube video, go, oh, I can't handle 90 minutes of this, is going to be boring.
That's what 2X is for.
Well, there's 2X. Some people, I won't mention names, speak at 2X already. So just be aware that if you go to 2x in this, you might actually have 4x in practice for some of these demo parts. But I still, I think that is one that a lot of people would have some use out of.
Okay.
If they're Studio users.
Well, I came in right at the end of that one and thought, oh, I got to go back and watch the rest of this. And I'm still in that state, unfortunately. But
I have the same goal. After I/O 2, I go and I add all these, like, these talks to the watch later list. My watch later list.
Yeah.
Seems to be like my to-do list. It is, you know, monotonically increasing. That's how it is.
We should have a watch it week.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea, actually. Because if you wait too long, you figure, that content is stale. I'll just wait for the next IO. You know, what could I possibly learn from Chet and Dan Sandler now? It's January already. Speaking of that, I guess the new IO has been scheduled.
I saw a tweet about it.
Yeah, I think it's May 18th. And he also tweeted that it's going to be in Shoreline Amphitheater.
Yes.
I saw Aerosmith there. So I have a lot of expectations for the keynote.
So is that the rumor, is that Aerosmith is playing IO?
We're starting it right now. Just to be clear, I'm speaking as an individual. I do not represent Google in any way.
I have no idea. You sort of look at Shoreline on Google Maps and there's a tent and a lawn, you know, not even a tent. It's just an awning over a big open space with seats and a lawn. I have no idea what it means to
Yeah, I sat on the grass when I watched Aerosmith. So yeah. It'd be kind of odd to sit and watch a technical keynote, but it'd be kind of exciting, I guess.
Yeah. We'll see what happens. I haven't heard anything other than that tweet that just came out yesterday.
Actually. And it wasn't April 1st, right?
It was not. Maybe it was an early. He was getting a start on April 1st.
Yeah, could be. So I'm sitting here thinking I must surely have forgotten something big in Android Studio 2.0. So I just want to pre-apologize for the things I didn't mention and make it clear that you really should check out our tools.android.com/recent blog where we kind of post announcements about each release.
And also, if we did forget some important technical details in this episode, I just want to make it clear that it's Tor's fault.
I think in this case, you actually would be right.
Okay.
I have been talking a lot. And I can already think of things that I have forgotten. Things like, I know we added more improvements for testing, and I think there was some improvements to the vector stuff. And obviously, we updated to IntelliJ 15. Right, which is a big release. So IntelliJ has been doing annual releases, right? So IntelliJ 14.1 is what everything up to Studio 1.5 was based on. In 2.0, we switched to IntelliJ 15. So all the fixes in the last 8 months from JetBrains. And there's some awesome features in there as well.
So, and new iconography. It looks different every time I launch IntelliJ.
Yeah, they changed their branding.
Yep.
So, you know, there's that.
Actually, there is the vector stuff. I forgot that as well because I forgot when that hit. But there was a new there's like clip art stuff that you can grab.
Yeah, and we had some of this in 1.4 and 1.5, but we keep iterating on it. Yeah. You know, Tengui, yep. You know, from your team is doing a great job there. So,
yep. Yeah.
So this is a you know a Android Studio 2.0 appetizer. It is not sort of a complete representation of everything we ship.
So go out, get the new studio, be a canary. No, don't be a canary. Get the canary. Be a miner.
Yeah. Yes. And I think that we definitely want feedback on the brand new stuff, things like Instant Run, right? It's doing a lot of crazy things. And things like the hot swap is pretty, you know, it's pretty similar across different versions of Android, but to do things like resources and to do class load, you know, class injection, we're relying on a lot of runtime reflection and crazy hacks, right? And so this works on a lot of platforms that we've tested, but it might not work everywhere. So, you know, if you discover that you have some special phone or some special version of some phone and it doesn't work for you, we'd like to know about it so that we can go in, maybe ask some diagnostics or get, you know, buy that hardware ourselves and try it and figure out, it turns out on this device we have to do, you know, the example I can think of right now is that to support both, you know, API 15 and 18, there were several changes to the resources class. So we have to try reflection several different ways. Like in one case, it's a hash set, and then it switches to an array map, and so we have to cover it all. And it might be that on certain devices, there are other cases we have to cover as well. So detailed bug reports, you know, preferably with code to reproduce, would be highly appreciated.
Awesome. All right. Well, I want to say thank you to our guest.
Yeah.
But the guest didn't make it, so I won't. So I'll say thank you, Tor.
Well, thank you, Chet.